Super K.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Johnny Jungle Guts.
And I am Professor Extra.
And you're listening to a new episode of Super Gay, a podcast where we talk about all things gay in comics and more.
But mostly comics.
So before we get into our topic for this episode, yeah. our characters for this edition of our auditory encyclopedia, Alex is back on Instagram, so you can follow him there. Where can people follow you, Alex?
Prof Extra is my pseudonym, my nom de plumage.
And you also, I'm sure many of you listened to our interview episode with Luciano Vecchio. And Alex actually got him to draw Moondragon, your new fave.
Yeah. But yes, Moondragon, who will be a subject in an upcoming episode, is a lesbian monk from outer space who first appeared in the 1970s as a villain and went through many different times in her life in the decades that ensued as an Avenger or a Defender or an enemy of the Avengers or an enemy of the Defenders. And she's currently a Guardian of the Galaxy. And Luciano Vecchio was kind enough to allow me to pay him to draw her. And he's been drawing a lot of really great characters. I gotta say, you know, this is turning into the Luciano Vecchio podcast, but he drew Cosmic Boy in his 1970s outfit, and that was so hot. Did you see that?
Oh, of course. Yeah, great.
Bam. It was perfect. And he even had little, like, curls behind his ears because his hair was sort of long. I thought that was hot. Yeah, it looked great. Great belly button work there, Luciano. Thanks much for that. And yeah, I'm back on Instagram. I took a year and a half off, and now if you do want to follow me there, it's kind of fun. Mostly I post images from comics. There's sometimes you'll see me pop up here and there. It may shift a little bit in the next year as projects come up that I've been working on for a while. So I don't know. Yeah, follow me on Insta. I'm there.
Super K.
I really like the ads that I've been away for a year. I've got to say, two things have changed. It's much more of a pickup site now. People like DM you and stuff, which is intense. And then the other thing is that every third post is
brutal.
An ad for some kind of weird pants that I could buy that are kind of like fast fashion knockoffs of something from Europe or Asia.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, like a lot of that for me. And then I also get a lot of like body protection devices, like knee socks that just like keep your knees from, like, I guess breaking open or something, and like thing on you put on your back that makes you stand up straight, and it feels very superhero. And I wonder if they kind of target people who post superhero stuff with like weird physical contraptions that will make you superhuman. I don't know.
Yeah, I get a lot of like amateur stand-up comics. That's what I get a lot of online.
Wow. All right. So interesting. I mean, they just really, they know us.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's kind of funny because it's like, it makes me wish that there were like, you know, like everyone hates commercials, but suddenly I'm like wishing for like standards in commercials, because like on Instagram, anyone can pay to advertise, right?
So you also, as I understand it, have been on social media late, like most of humanity.
Sure.
And it seems that for once, someone who you was always in your good graces.
It was hard to get him out of my good graces, yeah.
Okay, and I was angry with him like multiple times and trying to convince you to be angry. And
yeah,
you
were. Mm-hmm.
And his name is Rob.
His name is Rob Liefeld, the supreme diva himself. But
So for the listeners who don't know who Rob Liefeld is, how would you describe who this person is?
Rob Liefeld is an artist who came up in the 90s and late 80s drawing New Mutants and then X-Force. He is a self-taught artist. He's often lumped into the categories of sort of the founders of Image Comics, which includes Jim Lee, Todd McFarlane, people like that. Mm-hmm. But whereas a lot of those fellows never quite tickled my fancy, Rob Liefeld's sort of bizarre drawing style, almost bordering on a, I don't know, it's so over the top, it becomes campy because it's just incredible, huge chested men and women, cinched waists. He does not like
too
to draw
much
feet.
Detail.
A lot of detail, yeah, a lot of pouches.
Detail on everything but the feet. He invented Deadpool. I think that's his true legacy. I don't know what else. Cable, I think, was sort of his design, at least.
Yeah.
Shatterstar is our personal favorite.
That's right.
Of the group, at least. And we have done an episode on him. So, you know, we have definitely touched Rob Liefeld's treasure chest, as it were. Mm-hmm. But he has got a crazy personality on the internets, and he has been complaining a lot lately about contemporary X-Men comics, which is not coincidental, I don't think, with the fact that he also recently had a sort of failed attempt at an X-Men comic that was a sort of Rob Liefeld returns to X-Men in 2018 with this thing called Major X.
That's right.
And it was a kind of a disaster area, although it did give us a Summers Monroe child.
I know, that
so Major
was
X
shocking.
Is the child of Storm and Cable.
Uh-huh.
That was his big contribution, but it didn't work out. This new X-Men thing is going really well. Everybody loves it, and he's online complaining about it all the time, which is really intense.
Oh, it's really intense, but it's that also is just like funny and immature to me. But the line Rob kind of crossed was when he said Kitty Pryde was an avatar for weirdos, or he was sad that Kitty Pryde had become an avatar for weirdos, which
he
obviously
said,
is
well, he literally
referencing.
So what do you
probably
think that means?
Bisexual or just gay people in general. And so he kind of lost me there.
Yeah, he literally tweeted that, right? He said, sad Kitty Pryde is now an avatar for weirdos.
That's exactly what he said. And, you know, people were like, well, what does that mean, Rob? And of course he would not really elucidate. So that was, because all the other stuff was just immature.
So the people for whom Deadpool is an avatar are not weirdos.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
a good point.
We know who they are. Who are those people?
Who are the Deadpool fans? They're the sort of trolls, fuckboys of the internet, I would say. There's another term, edgelords. I think Deadpool is an avatar for edgelords.
He's the edgelord par excellence. And then who is Shatterstar an avatar for?
The gays, I would say.
Exactly. So, I don't know, Rob.
I don't know, Rob. Get it together. But
so, should we do a Kitty Pryde episode?
We probably should at this point, since it's become such a thing
her sexuality
on Twitter.
I feel like Kitty Pryde's sexuality is the elephant in the super gay room.
Yeah, I mean, I never even thought twice about it until you brought it up one time, and now I'm seeing it everywhere. Everyone's always talking about Kitty Pryde's romances.
Is that her sexuality for me was very much defined by her crush on Colossus that coincided with my crush on Colossus.
Sure.
So I thought that was her sexuality, and then his sister was sort of her confidant in that, in a kind of, I don't know, 19th century romance way. But everybody else saw it the other way around.
Yeah.
It seems. So, I don't know. It's time to really disambiguate. But we got to find a good Kitty Pryde fan to help us.
We do.
So, if you're out there, we're taking submissions.
I thought it was me, but apparently not.
No, I think we need... Yeah, that's the thing. Because you didn't see it, right?
I didn't see it at all. Nope. Didn't pick up on it at all.
All right. So, let's
speaking of edgelords, what would be the female what would be the female term for edge countess?
Well, lady
edge
is
lady lords and ladies, that's right, edge ladies. We're getting into the
lords and countesses. The duchess of edge
herself, Harley Quinn, but also Poison Ivy is our topic for today.
I love Poison Ivy.
I do love Poison Ivy. But I think you think I like Harley Quinn more than I probably do. I think what it is that I just, neither of us like Batman, but I do love Gotham City. And so if we can have a comic set in Gotham City without Batman, I will take Harley Quinn over Batman any day of the week.
What do you love about Gotham City?
What do I love about it? I think one of the things I love about it is the way these weird thematic elements that have nothing in common end up becoming sort of linked to each other. Like bats and cats have nothing to do with each other. Bats and clowns have even less to do with each other.
I mean, bats and cats have a lot to do with each other. Their cats are bats that don't have wings.
Okay. Or you could say bats are rats with wings that cats would chase. you could say that, too. Oh,
okay. Yeah, okay. But Bats and Clowns, I take your point. It gets starting to get a little weird.
That doesn't have anything to do with each other. And then today we're talking about Plants and Clowns, which is also the same. Right. And I think I just love the, you know, I love
when I
like
think of
absurd.
Clowns, I think of plants.
When you think of clowns, you think of plants.
Yeah, I don't know. No, you don't. That's why, yeah, you're right. So you have this thing, and I was thinking about this. When a DC comic book team shows up, everybody's got a different color on.
Yeah. It's
That's
true.
That's the aesthetic. You know what I mean? And they're from different zones. Yeah. So you got the plant girl with the clown girl. And that's what we're dealing with Harley and Ivy.
It sure is.
So can you disambiguate these people for me? Because I think of all Gotham City villains as having the same exact origin. So maybe you could explain to me what exactly is the story behind Harley, Quinn, and Poison Ivy.
Well, there are two slight variations on the Harley origin story. One is in both she's the Joker's therapist in Arkham Asylum, and he sort of charms her into a life of crime.
Sure, my puddin's a little temperamental. But gee, what relationship doesn't have its ups and downs?
But then there are other versions where he also throws her into the same Joker acid that he fell into that created him. And so she's sort of further psychologically altered by that whole experience. Mm. What's interesting...
Are there physical...
Oh. Yeah, her physical appearance is altered. Yeah, her skin is then permanently whitened, similar to his. But what's funny is that they don't even include that as part of the Joker's origin now in this new Joker movie. So it's like the Batman characters, specifically the villains, their origins are always very multiple choice because there's been so many different continuities and different versions. Like Poison Ivy, for example, in some storylines is she was a student of Jason Woodrue, the Floronic Man, who we talked about in our New Guardians episode quite a bit. And he gave her plant powers, which are often very ill-defined. But then in other versions of the story, she's simply a botanist who just sort of goes...
Figure stuff out.
Yeah.
She's an evil botanist. I mean, I kind of understood that part about her. I don't know why.
It's almost all you need to understand a little bit, you know?
Right. Well, it's helpful, too, though, because it means that there's some kind of expertise it's actually a science angle, even though she kind of has magic-y, like witchy nature powers, right?
Yeah.
So Poison Ivy is often kind of, as a result of that, also sort of portrayed as an environmentalist.
Oh yeah.
And even like an eco-terrorist, I guess you could say, right? Like she would have joined ELF.
Earth Liberation Front, a secretive group. Fear of their attacks grew across 7 western states, living in warehouses, communicating by code.
Oh, yeah.
And I really like that about her. But she sort of looks like a femme fatale kind of character. So she's wearing like a green, would you say that's leaf bikini?
Yeah, usually she's wearing a leaf one piece. Yeah,
a leaf one piece that's like strapless, right?
Usually,
usually. And then often with green tights, sometimes nothing, and sometimes a black bodysuit underneath in our more shall we say circumspect era that we live in.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, they all have to have functional costumes. When she gets her powers from the Floronic Man, who is that again?
He's the same guy who is in the New Guardians, Jason Woodrue. He's the plant guy.
Okay, so he looks like the carrot-nosed guy.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes she gets her powers from an evil guy, and then sometimes Harley gets her powers from an evil guy, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes something else happens.
Right, yes. There's like a sort of an abusive male figure in both of their lives.
I see.
To a certain extent, I would say.
Right.
Saying it's interesting you brought up the idea of the femme fatale, because in a lot of classic noir films, they usually end with a sort of moral lesson wherein the evil femme fatale dies. but I read a book about the history of Catwoman, actually, where they talk about how comics sort of subverted that trope because they couldn't just kill off a villain every issue because then they would need to come up with a new villain. So since they wanted to keep using the same villains, the females don't die in a moral lesson, and so they get to sort of have more of a life of their own than they normally would and be seen in a less negative light. I don't know. I just always think of that when I think of Batman and femme fatales.
Right. I mean, it's kind of interesting in this case because you have two characters who do resemble different kinds of femme fatale. One, the sort of Veronica Lake, hair over one eye, redhead, and the other one more of a manic pixie dream girl.
Sure.
But they both kind of align to particular issues that also have a kind of feminism to them. So one is psychoanalysis in the case of Harley, who's a doctor, right?
Sure.
And then the other one is environmentalism, which is or some kind of interest in ecology and the earth.
Sure.
Which is Poison Ivy's thing. So when they're not beholden to a guy for their powers exclusively, it seems like they have a kind of shared kind of politics that's weirdly complementary to each other. And in both of them, you can see a kind of seed of feminism, but they are really very defined in a lot of ways by a kind of male gaze and like a male world that they live in. So that's part of one of the reasons why I'm sort of like freaked out by them sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's very fair. I mean, even going back to Batman the Animated Series where Harley debuted and this relationship sort of began, you know, that show was the brainchild partially of Bruce Timm and his art style. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he, if you look at any of his art, is a very horny heterosexual man. I know he's spoken about, they did an episode of Batman where it was Calendar Girl instead of Calendar Man, and his explanation was, I just wanted to draw more, like, sexy ladies. That was his, like, logic.
Some of that early stuff
comes off of, it's a very lesbian Pulp Fiction novel vibe that I'm getting. So that's definitely in there, too.
Right. Right.
And it's hard to sort out what's the male fantasy and what's not, and when it's okay for it to be maybe, you know, someone's fantasy a little bit. But
so, let's go back in time and see when they first appeared. But one of the things we should just mention at the outset is the reason we're talking about Harley and Ivy is because even though it's not always canon, it currently is that they at least have had some kind of sexual relationship with each other.
Oh, yeah.
And that they continue to return to each other all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have a comic book together. Even though their coupledom is sort of in limbo, they have a history, at least, and they sexualize each other a lot in their conversation in more contemporary comics.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to get to that, but we'll start with 1966. Which is the first appearance of Poison Ivy in Batman number 181. And who made this comic book?
The cover's by Carmine Infantino, legendary Carmine Infantino, but it's written by Robert Kaniger with art by Sheldon Moldoff.
I like the art a lot. It's very classic DC, very, very like kind of generic, but like perfect.
Oh, yeah.
I have to say.
It's exactly what you want.
So what's the plot of Poison Ivy's first appearance?
Well, Poison Ivy is trying to outdo these other three female villains, all of whom have insect themes. So I just thought that was maybe like some kind of like, you know, insects in a Venus flytrap thing. And so she's trying to outdo them. She thinks she's a better villain, but the only reason she's not famous like they are is because she hasn't been caught yet. So
Right.
She throws a big PR stunt where she tries to get them all over to this sort of abandoned mansion.
Art gallery?
Maybe. Oh. Is it her house? I'm not sure.
It's like looks like an art gallery. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, they start out in an art gallery where they're viewing portraits of these beautiful villains, Batman and Robin are. And then Poison Ivy shows up.
Well, why don't we read that? Because I feel like it's just such perfect writing. Why don't you read the, let's see. You read the narration, and you read Batman, and I'll read Robin, and I'll read Poison Ivy.
Okay.
How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay, let's try this.
At the Gotham City Museum, Bruce Wayne, millionaire sportsman and playboy, and his young ward, Dick Grayson, attend a sensational pop art show. There they are, Dick. Dragonfly, Silken Spider, and Tiger Moth. Three of the most beautiful women in the world, and the most deadly. Stop drooling. You're too young.
I can dream until I'm old enough to try to catch them, can't I?
At that moment, a startling outburst.
You men are such fools. If you weren't so blind, you would see that I'm not only more beautiful, but more successful than those amateurs. Why, you don't even know of my crimes. They're so perfect. That's the only mistake I made. Committing such perfect crimes that I haven't gotten any publicity out of them.
You are luscious, Dreamboat. But, as for being world public enemy number one, mind proving that to the police?
For you, handsome, anytime. No handcuffs are needed. Just slip your arm through mine and call me Ivy. Poison Ivy.
But of course she escapes.
Yes, she escapes. Can we just talk about her? Her outfit here, her first appearance outfit is really cute. She has a crown made out of leaves. She has a necklace made out of leaves. She has a bracelet made out of leaves. She has her signature kind of bustier, Beyonce sort of bodysuit thing.
Sure.
And then she has these lovely light green tights. And then her hair is great. She has bangs,
yep.
Auburn hair bangs, and kind of a little flip. And the green tights have a really beautiful detail of a vine going down the side.
Yes, they
and
do.
It's just perfect. So she's got this template that you kind of can't fuck up once you know, everybody copies this a million times over into different costumes, and it always holds her. She's always in it. It's definitely Poison Ivy.
I wish they did the crown a little more often.
I like the crown. I know. It's cute. And I actually think her hair being shoulder length with bangs is really nice.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It makes her seem smart instead of just like totally
Jessica Rabbit, yeah.
Yeah, because she can veer into Jessica Rabbit territory, and that can be kind of disturbing, I have to say. But anyway, yeah, so she does this whole trick on these girls who are really funny, the kind of C-list insect girls,
mm-hmm.
Where she brings out an electrified crown that they all grab because they all want the crown of being the number one evil girl of town. I don't know. That's, I guess, the plot.
Very sought-after title.
Yeah. One thing I thought was kind of interesting is that, so they all get electrocuted by holding onto this crown that she tricks them into grabbing, and she says, "How thoughtless of me not to mention that I used shockproof gloves to hold the crown. It's electrified just enough to keep you dancing a sizzling frog until the police get here." So one thing I wanted to say is that she's got it's 1966. She has a go-go vibe, which is kind of fresh, refreshing in a way for Batman, which everything does really adhere very closely to this like 40s kind of aesthetic, you know, and she comes in and kind of brings a little bit of 60s energy, flower child kind of, you know what I mean?
That's true.
She's like flower child gone mad kind of character. Yeah.
And that's very of the time too, because, you know, in the culture, I think there was a lot of paranoia about what that whole movement was. And
right.
In 1966, the Batman TV show is airing. So she's just missing the cutoff for that. Which I always wondered about as a kid, why Poison Ivy was never in the Adam West show, and now I know it's because she came out the year that show was airing, so she didn't really get the traction to, you know, appear the way Catwoman did, for example.
Exactly. And, you know, we haven't mentioned Catwoman. I know that she's one of your favorite characters.
Yeah, maybe my favorite, really.
Maybe your favorite. And, you know, I think both Harley and Ivy, and one of the reasons they kind of need each other is that it takes like two other characters to kind of add up to the crazy energy that Catwoman holds in the Batman universe, you know?
Sure.
But they're all spun off from her in some way or another. Especially I think the way Harley ends up. But in any case, so let's talk about the Batman animated series. So this is definitely where Harley Quinn comes from. She is not a comic book character.
Yes, originally. She did not originate in the comics. Arlene Sorkin, as I understand it, was an actress who was appearing on daytime TV, and there was a dream sequence on whatever show it was, General Hospital or something like that, where Arlene Sorkin was dressed up as a harlequin, as a clown.
Okay, two drummer boys go into a bar. Ba-dum-ba-dum-bum. Boy, you're a rough crowd.
And so they saw that and came up with this idea for her to do the voice for a gun mall type character that would accompany the Joker in her first appearance in September 11th, 1992, in an episode called The Joker's Favor.
To me, she reminded me of Judy Holliday, the actress from The Silver Screen. Do you know her?
I don't.
She was in this movie called Born Yesterday. Well, let's listen to a clip of
her. You know why? You're the greatest.
Oh, leave me alone, Harry!
Come here!
No!
I never seen you like
this! I feel like I want to go away from.
Where?
I don't know.
Well, I'll wind up here in a couple of weeks. We'll go to Florida, maybe.
Leave me alone!
You know what I think? I think you're gone nuts.
Maybe.
All right, calm down.
I can't.
Why not?
I don't know. I just know I hate my life. There's a better kind. I know it. And if you read some of these books, you'd know it, too. Maybe it's right what you say. I'm still dumb. But I know one thing I never knew before. There's a better kind of life than the one I got. Who are you?
She is the kind of character voice that that voice is sort of based on.
Okay.
And it just sort of keeps going, you know. But it is that, like, funny. They sound both dumb, blonde, and witty at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, super smart. And also they miss, you know, they like mispronounce words or use malaprops or something, you know?
Yes.
So what does Harley Quinn do in her first appearance? And that was 1992, correct?
Oh, yes, it was. She's kind of just a background character, but just something to give a little bit more color and flavor to the henchman sphere of what's going on with the Joker. The episode's mostly about a guy who is sort of entrapped by the Joker into doing his bidding, and it's sort of a story of this guy's life and his paranoia. And, you know, after he first meets the Joker, he moves and changes his name so that the Joker won't know where to find him at another time. It's kind of a classic episode. Another thing I'm thinking about when you're talking about, you know, the witty but seemingly dumb character is, I think Peggy Bundy was sort of in the ether at this time, 1992 as well, who is a very sort of similar character in that she is very smart, but is sort of initially presented as the sort of, you know, dumb wife to the lead of Married with Children. I don't know. I just, that popped into my head too.
Okay, so so she shows up, and she's cute, and everybody loves her, and she looks like a harlequin. And so her popularity, I think, I mean, it was interesting because I watched that show when it was coming out, and I remember being like, oh, I like this character, you know? And I don't know, she kind of, like, synthesized some of the issues. Malik, my partner, when I told him we were doing this, he said, oh, who's that girl? She's kind of like club, what did he say? She's kind of like a Monte Carlo trading card, like assassin girl. And I was like, yeah, that one.
Well, the animators really liked her as well. And they really thought there was something interesting about this character. And so, you know, even before I think she debuted, they wanted to keep reusing her as someone for the Joker to talk to, you know. Sidekicks originally came into existence simply to give superheroes someone to talk to before they'd really gotten into the whole thought bubble thing. And when you're in animation, you don't have as much thought bubble
stuff. Right. Interesting. I didn't know that. But that makes sense. From a theatrical standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. So, and then Poison Ivy first appears in 93, so like a year later. And these are both written by Paul Dini, am I correct?
Yes, I believe so. Certainly that first, certainly the first time Harley and Ivy team up was.
Right.
But I just want to point out that that first episode that Poison Ivy appears on is sort of like a horror movie wherein Batman is really the monster, because she is after Batman and actually Harvey Dent before he's turned into Two-Face on that show. She's after them because they've built a prison on top of this area that was the only habitat for this extremely rare flower. So that's like really stupid and messed up that, you know, like what's that really about? That. You know, the prison industrial complex that billionaire Bruce Wayne is funding. And so then she's furious about that and tries to kill Harvey Dent by using her signature poison kiss. And
she wears poison lipstick a lot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, vacillates whether it's poison lipstick, whether it's like an innate power of hers. But this idea that she has some sort of deadly kiss is a very, very recurring element of Poison Ivy's whole thing.
Like the plant she's named after.
Exactly. Yes. So,
but it doesn't give you rashes. It usually makes you pass out. That's the usual thing.
Yes.
So it.
Yes.
So she kisses this lawyer guy who helped the plants go extinct in a restaurant. And his face falls in the soup, and then it turns out he's going to become Two-Face later. So he's Batman's best friend, or Bruce Wayne's best friend, or whatever. And then he comes, and then it turns out that Batman like burns her house down.
Yeah,
and
then he goes to her greenhouse, just burns it to the ground. It's just there's nothing you can like about Batman in this entire parade of idiocy that he's participating in.
But there
in.
Is exactly, but there is something that you can enjoy about Poison Ivy.
Absolutely.
Her voice is really great, and her voice actress is Diane Pershing, and she has a smoky, intelligent kind of like delivery that's really great. And she says, "Enjoy extinction, Batman."
Oh my god! At one point, so great.
Yeah. So you're on her side the whole time. It's really funny, but I think it kind of presupposes a hostility toward environmentalists. Actually, the way it's set up. But in the execution, I mean, you definitely are more seeing things from her point of view than Batman's at a certain point.
Oh, yeah.
I felt, anyway. Yeah.
And I just also want to do, we're talking about voices here, I want to do a shout out to Andrea Romano, who did the voice casting for this show and many, many DC animated joints. And the reason why the voice acting is so good is because she is just epically good at casting people. I actually had a friend whose dad was the actor John Hurd, who was cast in one of these movies, and he was telling me about how shocked he was at the level of scrutiny he was being put under by this lady, because he thought he was just going in for a cartoon, and then it was like, you know, an actual audition, you know?
Right.
I just felt like I had to shout her out, because she's so great.
Well, good work.
Good work, Andrea.
So, Harley and Ivy from January 8, 1993, written by Paul Dini. So this is where Harley and Ivy first become a thing.
Yes. Yes. And it sort of kickstarted this entire relationship and also sort of remains the best sort of product of this relationship, in my opinion. You know,
it's a perfect episode.
It's a perfect episode. It's, in my opinion, maybe the best episode of the whole show.
Well, hello.
I think I'm in love.
Auga, auga.
Ow!
Excuse me, boys. Didn't your mommies tell you that's not the nice way to get a lady's attention?
Oh, and what are you gonna do? Spank us?
That's right, pigs. And here's the paddle.
Whoa! It's sort of fascinating because you see the way social mores have sort of shifted since 1993, because this is obviously a cartoon that's produced for children, but it features some domestic abuse between Harley and the Joker, which is shocking. And then doesn't openly feature the idea that, you know, Harley and Ivy could be a couple. But
no.
It's also coming out around the time of Thelma and Louise. That was about 2 years before this. And so it's sort of doing some of the same subtextual things.
It references Thelma and Louise at the end, especially when they're sort of driving off into the sunset and about to get away, and then Renee Montoya pops up because one of them says, like, you know, no man can stop us, and of course then a female cop comes, a lesbian female cop from the DC universe. So that's a trope. But anyway, in this one, yeah, they're kind of, they team up, but I don't remember exactly why. I watched it recently, but they just sort of naturally sort of end up together.
Yeah, they're both doing a job, and they accidentally are doing the same robbery at the same time, so they help each other out.
Right, which is a kind of, that is like kind of solidarity, feminist solidarity there. And then, you know, the whole time, like, as they get closer and they kind of go on the run together, they start to come up with kind of a working relationship that succeeds in certain ways. And then Batman is, like, stalking them, you know? This is so awful.
Right. It repeats this idea of Batman sort of being almost the villain of the story, because we don't really see a lot from his perspective throughout the course of this episode. He just kind of will show up to stop them.
I mean, he's stopping them from doing crimes.
True.
You know? And then there's also this thing where they're always trying to put both of them in an insane asylum. That's kind of like a classic move of the patriarchy.
Sure.
You know? And at one point, Ivy says, "This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship." And I guess it is. There's something about the energy where I think a certain pattern of behaviors sets in. Poison Ivy's always trying to convince Harley to get out of this relationship with her abuser.
That's absolutely right. And that continues till the Harley Quinn show that just debuted like yesterday. I watched the first episode of that, and it's the exact same dynamic.
And Ivy's on that show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Is she cool?
She's cool, yeah. I would say it seems like, I mean, there's only the first episode out, but they're almost giving as much weight to Harley and Ivy's relationship as they are to Harley and the Joker's relationship. And it's just the first episode, so this is where she's kind of getting out of it. But, you know, it's an okay. I mean, it kind of has the sort of some notes of like Adult Swim / Family Guy that I don't like. But there were some interesting plot twists that I actually thought were pretty funny.
Is Harley still the Duchess of Edge?
Yeah, I mean, the whole premise of the show is like sort of very similar to a Deadpool piece, because there's a lot of cursing, there's a lot of blood. It's that. It's totally that. Yeah.
Okay. Hot. so okay. So that's kind of like the origin of their relationship. How does it continue in other animated shows?
Well, I just think it's interesting that it carried on through, you know, two other animated series, which I think is part of why it feels so solidified and why you think of Harley and Ivy together. It wasn't just some one-off episode. They really were interested in this relationship. And so then they pop up again on the new Batman Adventures, which was really just happened after Batman the Animated Series got some budget cuts and all the designs of the characters had to get kind of more minimal. But
I see.
They're not bad. It's just a little bit more of an Art Deco character design to match the architecture. Two episodes really come to mind from that period. One is Holiday Nights, which is where Harley and Ivy brainwash Bruce Wayne into buying them a bunch of stuff on a Christmas shopping spree.
Yes. Oh, this reminds me. So one of the tropes of their relationship that gets established in that first Batman the Animated Series episode, Harley and Ivy, is they hang out in sort of t-shirts with no pants a lot together in some kind of domestic environment. Like, that gets depicted repeatedly.
Yes, it does.
But in this one, they do a shopping spree montage that's super cute, and I actually liked the fashion in that sequence. There's one part where they put on these really big hats that actually it made me laugh.
It was, it's great.
Yeah, but then the other one is Girls' Night Out, which is really more focused on them, and it also includes that character Livewire, who's a kind of... Well, where does she come from?
I think she was also an original creation of Superman the Animated Series and voiced by Lori Petty, who played Tank Girl. So there's kind of a... I don't know. I mean, Tank Girl was in love with the Kangaroo Man, but I think there was just a certain female empowerment to that whole moment. And then Livewire, she was like a radio shock jock who somehow got these electricity powers. But she has short blue hair, and yeah. kind of this a little bit of a gravelly voice. So the whole crew, you know, you can kind of sense that Harley feels like worried that Livewire is going to take her place over the whole outing. And it kind of is almost, to a certain extent, a little bit of a, you feel almost a love triangle situation or a concern coming off of Harley.
It looks
throughout.
A lot like a lesbian love triangle situation.
It sure
complete
does.
Complete with like this... Harley keeps trying to open doors that she can't really open with her mallet.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I've literally seen people do that. I've seen friends of mine do that in lesbian love triangle situations.
Open doors with mallets.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's basically the... Yeah,
the metaphor.
That's the outcome a lot of the time.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, it all comes to nothing because they get beat up by, like, Supergirl and Batgirl, who are so annoying.
Yeah.
But there is a scene where Supergirl's flying around with her head between Batgirl's legs because Batgirl just, like, sits on her.
She sits on her back, yeah, as they fly around.
So her legs, she kind of rubs herself against the back of Supergirl's head while they're flying.
That's funny.
That's a thing that I noticed.
I didn't even think about how weird that is, but it is odd. I mean, all the
it's
carrying
not a usual
that happens.
Way. Yeah.
I love all the carrying that happens when there's like it happens in X-Men a lot too, where you'll have like Storm carrying Wolverine like almost like a little baby because he can't fly.
And he's smaller than her.
Yeah. It's so great.
That's really great. Yeah, carrying is one of the best things about flying. It's like your friend can fly around with you in some position. And here, Supergirl really gets what she wants out of it, too, I suppose. and Livewire seems pretty queer-coded to me.
Oh, yeah.
But it's particularly just the way that this becomes an all-woman episode, and then there's all these like dimensions of jealousy and competition. It gets really hot. So that's a kind of fun episode. I thought it was great. And then another show that you made me watch is called Static Shock.
I don't know why I threw this in here, but I just thought it was fascinating that they carried this over to like a whole nother show that had its whole own universe, but they still felt the need to do a Harley and Ivy episode. Also, I just think it's great that this Static Shock show happened, even though I don't know if I really like a lot of the choices they're making.
Right.
But it was a weird episode because basically, if I can explain the premise of Static Shock really briefly.
Please, let's just go into it.
And I know it more from the comic than the shows, but my understanding is what happened was there was this experimental tear gas that the police were using, and it accidentally gave a lot of people superpowers if they like survived it, and they became what was known as Bang Babies. And so Static himself is a Bang Baby with electricity powers. And then in this episode, we have another Bang Baby who has sort of like sharp fingernail powers. But she doesn't want to have these powers anymore. So she answers a newspaper ad advertising a cure for Bang Baby syndrome in Gotham City. And so she heads over there, and it turns out it's Harley and Ivy, and Ivy's been emailing with her over the internet. So it kind of comes off as this sort of like lesbians are gonna get you over the internet,
and
they're creepy, and they're gonna, you know, whatever, pervert your young mind.
Well, it was definitely like there was like a Stranger Danger message.
Oh, yeah.
And then they queered it with these two famous femme butch lesbians. Pretty crazy.
It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. I didn't know this show. How would you describe the sort of aesthetic of this TV show? And what was the animation technique used to make it, because it had a particular look that seemed very of its era? Which, what is the years of this cartoon?
That's a good question.
Let's look.
We might have to Google it because I didn't write it down stupidly.
It's okay.
It's definitely late 90s, but
American animated series premiered 2000.
2000. So it actually, you know what? Yes. It's worth mentioning that it's actually premiering after it was first intimated that Harley and Ivy were a thing in the comics, and it's also written by Paul Dini, who wrote many of these early Harley and Ivy joints, both inside and outside animation. But the reason why the animation in Static Shock looks the way it does is because there was a shift at that time from more hand-drawn techniques to using more digital computer techniques in animation. And it's a really... it's a really stark shift. You see it in the TV series Batman Beyond. The first couple seasons of that show
it's pixelated.
Are the first couple seasons of the show are using the more traditional style of animation that they used on Batman the Animated Series. Then I think you get to the third season of Batman Beyond, and they switch to digital. And frankly, it's a real loss because it's just not as I don't even know how to describe it, but it just looks, it looks more like a flash animation when they they have those early digital 2D cartoons.
Yeah, and they're also a little pixelated, like they're not as high res as the screens are now. But I thought for Static Shock, which is very of its period, you know, the sort of 2000s, and everything's got like a hip hop fake soundtrack.
That, yes, it does.
And
it,
like the song goes like superhero Static Shock or something like that.
Yes, it does.
And then in this episode where it's about this like young woman, teenage woman who wants to run away to live with these lesbian doctors, but everyone is against it. That they have this song that keeps playing. It goes like one step ahead of the game. Da, 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 dee, dee, doo, doo, doo. Do you remember this song?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah, because it is incessant. They are running it over and over again.
So is that unique to that episode? Does every episode have a theme song?
I don't know if every episode has a theme song, but it is not unique to that episode to have music with vocals in it as a sort of like background music. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I actually kind of had to stop myself from keeping watching Static Shock, even though I think it's actually really terrible. And so I don't know. It's on DC Universe, as is everything that we just discussed. And so that is how we were able to watch it. But we are going to end here for now and pick up on part two of our special Harley and Ivy two-part special to talk about their comic book appearances.
All right. Sounds good to me. So we will see you shortly in part two of Harley and Ivy.
This has been another episode of Super Gay, produced by Johnny Martin and Alexandra Segade, recorded at Razorcake Studios LA and in Soho, New York. Thanks to the artist Bearpad, our sponsor. Check him out at bearpadshop.com. Thanks to the Linoleum Knife, podcast of the cinema, for hosting us on their RSS feed. Write us a review on Apple Podcasts and please support us on patreon.com/supergays with a Z, where you will have access to other podcasts and other great stuff. Have a super gay day.
Catch a super gay guy. Hey, that's a super gay fun, fun, fun. Come on to super gay time. Join all the super gay fun. Let's have a super gay time.
Super gay.